So today, as Rafa and other people suggested, let's discuss preheating. So, the stage immediately after the end of inflation, and let's see if we can come up with some interesting ideas for, somehow, constraining this, stage observationally, or at least, engage more people to start working in the field. Let's first start by putting, preheating in some context, in the standard context. So let's draw the timeline. it's my birthday, I can do whatever. Let's see this somewhere here. So recombination happened around here. BVN happened here. So all of that is, a scientific fact. It's not a matter of opinion. Nobel Prizes have been awarded for that, so it's all good. Rest. It's still speculative, right? So we know quite well, the initial conditions for BVN. We know that the universe was radiation dominated by photons. There was a slight excess of, matter over antimatter. The universe was in local thermal equilibrium. So entropy was maximized, and there was some dark matter, and maybe some small little constant dark energy was there. But these four we know for a fact. Well, here most likely the QCD happened, the QCD phase transition happened around 1 microsecond in cosmic time. Probably the electric symmetry breaking happened here, 10 to minus 10 seconds. And the rest is quite speculative.
Actually, I have a dumb question. How do we know dark matter is there? Is that obvious?
Well, okay. I mean, dark matter. Okay, even if it wasn't here, it must have popped up somewhere here, right? So that close to. Yeah. Okay. So this is. Right. And and the rest is
Would it be easy to produce it after BVM?
Yeah.
If it wasn't there?
What is it?
Probably it's highly constrained, right?
A light axion can start oscillating after BVN.
It could have started oscillating, but it was there. Okay.
Dark energy at BVN and then start showing.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. That's perfectly fine.
That's perfectly fine. Sure. Okay. Well, that's the answer.
Right here. And I mean, there may have been some other, strange, components here, like early dark energy, whatever, which, can change additional to whatever a bit. And apparently, the early universe cosmology lost the idea of inflation as well. So inflation happened somewhere here for a time interval of, greater than 10 to minus 34 seconds. So inflation, it happens somewhere in the first second or maybe earlier, or doesn't matter, depends on the expansion history between the end of inflation and BBN. Why we love inflation? Well, it's a very economical explanation of the CMB, as we all know. I'm not going to motivate it or whatever, just quickly listing the cool things about inflation. It solves all these classical, problems, the horizon, flatness, monopole problems. To some people, they're essentially the same problem. That's why I just put them on the same line. So they're solved by inflation. More interesting, more appealingly, the inflation also solves or explains the CMB anisotropies. It explains both why we observe coherent acoustic peaks in the CMB power spectrum. So the coherence of the peaks pretty much tells us that those peaks are a consequence of energy density fluctuations, which oscillate in the same phase when they're on subhorizon scales, meaning that they had started oscillating as they re-enter the horizon, which implies that they were seeded while they were still superhorizon. And inflation provides a very natural, explanation for the generation, for this A causal generation of this, you know, nasty fluctuations. So the coherence, and obviously the famous NS minus 1 prediction. So yeah, inflation pretty much does the job, and by inflation, normally we mean just the quasi De Sitter state of expansion. Right. Of course, inflation leaves us with some problems, at least if we want to reconcile this explanation of the CMB with what we observe around BBN. The temperature of whatever matter species were around at the beginning of inflation would have redshifted tremendously by at least a factor of, you know, e to the 40 up to e to the 60. I mean, e to the 40 is for very low scale inflation, minimal number of e-folds. For good scale inflation, the minimal number of e-folds is at least 60. But as you can see, this is a tremendous redshift, which means that the universe was quite cold. The particle number concentration also got diluted tremendously. So the universe was also quite empty. So a very different universe from the one we observe at the beginning of BBN. And so basically, to resolve this, if you like, problems, we need to introduce the reheating process. Reheating is basically the transition from this stage, well, from this state of the universe to the state of the universe around BBN. The most, I guess, economical model of inflation, which can also account for, well, which also naturally leads to reheating, is the single field model of inflation, where you simply have a single scale field. We all know the story, with some potential, which can be mentioned here. And we postulate the existence of a slowly rolling condensate, which then starts rolling faster and faster. So this is slow roll, fast roll, and then it starts oscillating.
By the way, yeah, even without introducing the inflaton at this point, there is already over 2 pi temperature as long as you have other light degrees of freedom at that time.
Okay. Yeah, the Gibbs
so it's not that cold, because it all depended on what you said cold was relative to. If it's relative to that, mm-hmm, it can still be hotter than that. So 1 MeV.
Right. Yeah, I guess, the Gibbons Hawking temperature can be quite high for high scale.
That's right.
Yeah.
So only thing that's required is there be some light degree.
Right.
But at the end of inflation, no matter what is the inflationary mechanism, both degrees of freedom, exactly like that, they represent a very, very suppressed energy density compared to inflationary background, right? Completely
true,
suppressed.
True, but all you need is h over 2 pi to the fourth power as far as the energy density is concerned compared to 1 MeV to the fourth power.
Well, you need that to overtake the inflationary background. You need the inflationary background to...
No.
You're basically saying that it's really cold, yeah.
I'm talking about at the end of inflation.
So end of inflation, that h over 2 pi represents at most 10 to minus 12 a fraction of the total energy density of the universe.
Yeah, I understand that there's much more to dump.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is he said it was very cold.
Yeah.
It's not cold.
Okay,
it's not cold. It's actually pretty hot.
Point given.
Okay. It's hot, yeah. Because it's very curved, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
No, you are right. From
okay.
That point of view.
Well, but, yeah. At least, okay, I guess that what was at the beginning at least of inflation gets really cold, yeah. But then again, okay. Sorry. Okay. Point taken. Yeah, and probably, yeah. Well, at least this very simple picture, you know, provides a natural, you know, starting point for reheating, which occurs somewhere here. And by reheating, we just mean the standard model degrees of freedom taking over the inflaton in terms of energy. So the easiest way to, you know, make the standard model degrees of freedom take over the inflaton in terms of energy is by just simply letting the inflaton condensate decay into, you know, matter. Right, and this basically naturally leads us to to a reheating stage, which can be split, you know, generically speaking, into four substages. You can get, well, the first stage of reheating is the linear stage, where you pretty much treat the matter fields as, you know, quantum fluctuations in a time-dependent background, so nothing new. Quantum fluctuations in a classical time-dependent background. The second stage, well, and here these quantum fluctuations hopefully have some instabilities. They're unstable, which is basically a manifestation of particle production. As these quantum fluctuations eventually back-react on the inflaton kona Z, you enter the non-linear stage of reheating, and then where the inflaton condensate, the inflaton field, from being a condensate becomes quite inhomogeneous, and you also excite a lot of, you know, matter fields, basically. And the third and fourth stages, which are kind of optional, are the perturbative stage, where basically the inflaton, the remnant inflaton condensate decays perturbatively via some perturbative, you know, decay channels, such as Yukawa channels, for instance, into matter, and you completely basically remove this remnant condensate, which may be a problem for the initial conditions for BVN. And the last stage is the stage of thermalization, where the entropy gets maximized.
I have a couple of questions.
Yeah.
So when you say non-linear stage, you're including turbulence and not?
Indeed, yeah. I'll expand on that.
And why can't I go straight to stage 3? Why do I have to do 1 and 2?
Well, yeah, that's the most generic, you know, timeline of reheating. But yeah, none of these stages is compulsory, right? I mean, you might get away with only 3 and 4, or just 1 and
The reason I'm asking this is because you just used the word generic, and that's one of the questions I have, is what's really generic.
I think I might have an answer to this question as well, but yeah, in a minute, yeah. Yeah, but yeah, these two first stages, yeah, I just wanted to say, since this, you know, discussion, well, so far it's just a talk, is on preheating, we call these first two stages preheating, so... And the reason why we call them preheating is because here the state of the matter is highly non-thermal. So we're just, you know, preparing the universe for the for a transition to thermalization. Right. So
Kaloyan, it's true, since this is a discussion,
that
it's important to emphasize that this is not generic. You know, this is a possibility in a specific choice of inflationary sector, couplings to particle species, and the strength of those couplings.
Indeed,
you know, that doesn't need to be generic at all.
Unfortunately. So yeah, sometimes it can be very
generic
boring.
For us as preheating guys, that we do papers on preheating, because that's where the fun is, no? But if we think about whether it's generic in nature or not, of course we don't know. But certainly there are many regimes in which this doesn't develop. Unfortunately, you know.
So. It's possible to have all four stages, but yeah, I guess it depends on the models. Well, on the field, the number of degrees of freedom, as well as the strength of the couplings. Yeah, you can skip some of this. Yeah, so, yeah, but yeah, let's just quickly go through our, you know, understanding of this process, at least the most basic things that we understand about these processes.
Can I just, I think Scott, you've asked this question before as well, and I didn't just answer it, but we should maybe not immediately, but have a discussion about what is the likely scenario do you expect? Right? Because if the experts here in particle physics, what are the kinds of couplings should we expect? Should we expect that it should go through this stage or not? And I think depending on the nature of the coupling and the types of field we expect to be coupled, we can potentially put some constraints, okay, which feature will happen and not. So we should talk about it, if not today, just generally, like what do we expect at that stage?
Yeah, another question related, which actually you mentioned it collaterally, is really what is reheating. It's about these effects into producing the standard model degrees of freedom, because we know at the end of that line before BVN there is a standard model.
Right.
It's about producing whatever degrees of freedom which eventually will decay into the standard model. right. Which is often what people work out in the literature without connection whatsoever to the standard model.
Yeah, I think traditionally it's always been defined as when radiation domination happens.
So
one third.
This is what traditionally has been put forward, but now the question really emerges, is that enough? You know, because sometimes you can reheat into something that is completely disconnected to the standard model, therefore how do you get the standard model? And if you do get it because it's connected, you should really incorporate it from the beginning in your analysis, you know. Mm-hmm.
So I think traditionally the reason why that was set forth is you assume a high reheating temperature. When people are playing with low reheating temperatures, as they do more prominent, more often these days, then it does become a big issue, actually. Because if you're getting close to 1 MeV, you don't have much time for these suppressed operators for hidden sectors to decay to standard model fields.
Mm. But I think it was also for simplicity, that's for the sake
But I'm saying if you're reheating to a high temperature, you have plenty of time to decay to standard models. So even if you have weak coupling.
Sure. There is more room, of course, to happen. But normally it's not work out.
So it all depends on how close that is to that, right?
But my point of this is precisely because we know eventually the standard model has to emerge. If this intermediate sector into which we reheat in first place is really connected to standard model, it means that you should have the standard model incorporated from the beginning, depending on the coupling strength, and this might change the picture that actually you develop into reheating of these intermediate guys. You know? And I think that's why it's relevant to have a discussion about what is the consistency aspects we would really want to demand on reheating of the universe.
Yeah, I think you basically, roughly speaking, there are two types of coupling to the standard model, right? One that's connected directly through strong non-Planck suppressed operators versus Planck suppressed operators. And so in the case where it's connected through Planck suppressed operators, you probably need to have a high reheating temperature, you have plenty of room to get to 1 MeV, and then you're probably fine, okay. And then in the other case, you have stronger constraints on actually what happens during inflation from because of this stronger coupling. And then with respect to the particular whether this preheating is generic or not, I think if you have this kind of opening up potential, it is fairly generic, at least on some K scale, length scale, right? You'll get these instability these condensates breaking up.
It depends a lot on the strength of the coupling.
Yeah.
For example, for parametric resonance in chaotic inflationary scenario, in the moment you change the coupling a couple of orders of magnitude, you go to narrow resonance.
That's right, yeah.
There is not this effect. Yeah. So it's actually very tricky. If you read the classical Kaufman-Tarowski in the paper, they are in a very narrow range of couplings where they are working out the...
But if you are having natural coupling constants, all order one, and then if you have in the tachyonic regime, then there should be some K-scale where the inhomogeneity starts to grow, and then you'll get a little bit of a breakup of the homogeneous condensate.
Yeah, if they are that strong, for sure, but the problem is if they are so strong, normally you can also spoil inflation through the strength of these couplings, you know? So.
Well, this is at the end, so...
Just radiative corrections to the
inflation.
But radiative, it depends, right? If you push a inflaton field far into the large field strength, and if there's strong coupling, then you can actually decouple your particle that you're giving loop corrections to. So then they'll just decouple and they won't correct.
But anyway, the point is this interesting interplay one has to really look into to realize what is the strength of the natural of the couplings to have kind of effects and be okay with everything else, you know.
Okay, let's try a simple example to see how generic preheating is, right? So let's just, like in the good old days, have two fields, inflaton and a dot reheating field, whatever you want to call it. Let's start with this tri-star coupling, right? Sigma has mass dimension 1. It's the linear stage, so we treat chi as a quantum fluctuation, so we can just write its equation of motion. Let's forget about expansion for the moment, but we'll get back to it. We can treat chi as a quark fluctuation on top of this classical background. And since phi is oscillating, you can just, you know, write your favorite harmonic oscillator like equation, where omega, because of the oscillations of the field, is just periodic. This is called the Hills equation. And the Floch's theorem, there's a whole theory developed to solve these type of equations, and there is something that goes by the name of Floch's theorem, which tells us that the more generic solutions to this equation are of this form. You have two exponential solutions with opposite signs in the exponents, multiplied by some periodic functions. The periodic functions have the same period as the period of the frequency. And knowing what's omega, you can find mu. And basically, since here we have a couple of parameters, we also have m, which kind of determines the period of oscillations, we can generate this so-called Floch's chart of the Floch's exponent or Floch's index mu. We're normally interested in the cases where the real part of mu is non-zero. If it's non-zero, then at least always one of the exponential terms, you know, grows exponentially with time. So normally we just parameterize it by the strength of the coupling and the whatever's left on the other axis. And for this particular type of interaction, okay, the Floch's chart I think goes like that. Where the shaded regions are regions of non-zero Floch's exponent. Now, can anyone tell me what's the value here? For this particular type of coupling. Is it like 1, 2, 10, 0.2?
Maybe like half or something?
Exactly. A half, okay.
Isn't that just the perturbative close against with decay?
Exactly. Yeah. And here then?
I guess that's probably 2 to 2, so it's just 1.
Exactly. And here? Just for completeness, I want to make you get it wrong.
No, it's
okay. Okay. Yeah. So basically, as you say, this one is just a phi going into a chi. This one is two phis going into a chi, and this one is three phis going into a couple of chi's. But yeah, you always produce a pair of chi's, and for each of these guys, right? But since you have a condensate, you can get a collective decay of inflaton quanta, so simultaneous decay, and that's why these guys appear here. That's why these guys appear here, exactly.
So with that interaction, when you pass through zero, there's time dependence to produce the chi particles. But then it's going to go back up to order in Planck, at least on the first oscillation, right? So then chi has a Planck scale mass term induced by the interaction.
All right. So firstly, this is sigma phi over m squared. I don't know.
So it would decay back into phi, and then it would just keep.
I mean, you can make, you know, phi oscillate with a sub-Planckian amplitude. I mean, this is not necessarily, you know, like high-scale inflation here.
I mean, isn't the initial amplitude 0.3 in Planck or something?
Yeah, this is for exactly a quadratic. But yeah, I mean, this can be just an approximation to a potential that flattens off, right? I mean, it could be an alpha attractor potential I'm being quite schematic here. I'm just focusing on what happens exactly around the mean, right? I mean, I don't care much about that. Yeah. And yeah, it's obviously a very simple toy model. But basically, this is for.
You don't really get much of the inverse process, because one way to understand these exponentials is it's Bose-enhanced decays.
Exactly.
But when it becomes really heavy, there's no Bose-enhanced reverse decay, which is why it sort of dominantly goes one direction.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, here at the bottom, you get something that resembles perturbative decays, but still you get an exponential growth. And the reason why you get the exponential growth is because of the Bose enhancement coming from the accumulation of the daughter fields, right? So basically, your decay rate, effective decay rate, applying to a couple of particles, which you can calculate quite easily in the vacuum, is actually corrected by some Bose enhancement factors. Those are the occupation numbers of the inflaton and the daughter fields. And basically, that's the effective decay rate, right? And then if you were to compute how the occupation number of the guys changes, it's basically 2 times the effective one. And since here you have also an N, you see how very naturally, you know, this guy increases exponentially with time, with some index, which is a function of phi bar, because you have phi here. Right. And actually, you can compute this. You can, you know, really derive this guy quite easily by just sandwiching, you know, the computing the amplitudes between states which are not like the vacuum states, but you know, states of, you know, some occupation. And yeah, you can compute this mu this way, and then you can compare it to the actual analysis from the Floquet theorem, and you see that the two agree quite well. The cool thing here is that when you're at the bottom, when you're in this regime, omega dot over omega squared is always less than 1. So basically here you are producing particles adiabatically. So this is quite often this leads to narrow resonance, or rather most narrow resonances are essentially adiabatic particle production. So you can see that even for very small couplings, preheating can happen, right? So by preheating, I mean exponential amplification of modes. You don't really have to go to this regime to get an exponential growth. So in this sense, preheating can be relatively, you know, general. Obviously, we can go a bit crazy, and we can go here, where this is order one. And here, well then, omega dot over omega squared quite often, as you say, every time you, as you cross the origin, this guy becomes greater than or equal to 1. So you violate adiabaticity. So here you can get non-adiabatic particle production. And this is now called Brault resonance. And this almost always leads to Brault resonance. And we can understand this guy again physically by just, you know, remembering that this is, well, this has the same form as the Schrödinger equation. And instead of time, well, instead of spatial coordinate, we have time here. So this is equivalent to a 1D Schrödinger equation. And
I mean, I thought in the case of A, it's not efficient enough to let the inflaton completely decay.
In the case of, well, it speeds up the process, but yeah, at some point, yeah, once back reaction kicks in, yeah, you don't really destroy completely the condensate, and then you need stage 3 basically to deplete the condensate. Yeah. So after narrow resonance, yeah. So I guess if stage 1 has narrow resonance, then stage 3 is inevitable.
But like, so using some similar methods, can one analyze stability of this inflaton condensate during inflation, before the oscillation start?
Well,
how
I mean,
do we even think about it?
It's just QFT in, you know, a time-dependent background. I mean, that's how we think about
that's
it.
That's what this moduli trapping stuff is. I don't know if you've heard of it. Or even like particle production, where you try to get events for gravitational waves during inflation.
Right.
You can have a moment where inflation slow wall breaks and you have this particle production in a minute.
Well, the usual even scalar fluctuations is precisely this kind of effect.
It's not periodic. It's not periodic. It's not happening, so there's no deep Bose enhancement.
You just have the missing periodic element. That
yeah,
sure, sure. But I think there's some inverse problem, because when they're periodic, you can define actually particles in this condensate.
Yeah,
and
you need to know the amount
of this like kind of real like slow roll regime. I don't even know how to think about it in terms of particles or write these diagrams. Right?
But I don't think you need to think of it.
No, you could understand fields.
So you know, it in terms of particles at late time, because those are the observables, not at the early time vacuum states.
Yeah, but super horizon balls during inflation are always in this regime. They are always highly non-adiabatic. That's why you can't really define them as particles, right? So, yeah, I'm not sure how this can be applied. But yeah, as you say, here we have a lot, well, many intervals of time where you're still adiabatic, and only certain, you know, narrow periods of time or events where you become non-adiabatic, and there you produce the particles. Yeah, I mean, if you make the comparison with the Schrödinger equation, basically this can be, or this one, yeah, can be considered as a Schrödinger equation with, you know, an effective potential, time-dependent potential, which has bumps where the non-adiabaticity condition, well, is respected, or the adiabaticity condition is violated. And you have these extended periods of time where you're still adiabatic, right? And yeah, particle creation happens here. And you can, you know, do the standard WKB ansatz and write this in terms of whatever, like Bobrov coefficients. And basically treat these two solutions as an incident and reflected solution, right? And yeah, I mean, if you are really into it, you can compute, you know, the scattering rates here, or rather, you know, the scattering matrix. So you can, if you call this is J plus one, you can just connect the Bogoliubov coefficients on both sides of, you know, such a hill or a trough. I think that's how it went or something. Yeah. And basically, you see that, I mean, the bit on the left-hand side is kind of linear. Well, it's a linear function of the bit on the right-hand side, so you can put some arguments, and you see that, you know, the occupation number, which is proportional to beta squared, also kind of increases with time for certain parameters. So basically, this can kind of explain the broad resonance here. Of course, here you have narrow stability bands, and these are basically a reflection of the fact that you really care about the phases of the Bogoliubov coefficients just before you know, the incident wave hits the hill. The question is that, I mean, well, this kind of works for even omegas which don't evolve, you know, quite periodically, whereas, you know, this analysis works mainly for, you know, the narrow resonance works only when, you know, the potential evolves periodically.
I think just you comment on that.
Comment, yeah, and yeah, no, probably, yeah, I mean, yeah, please. Yeah.
I think maybe finish what you think.
No, yeah, and the question is what happens if this omega is super erratic, right, where you cannot really, you know, apply the Hills, well, the Hills analysis or the Floki analysis. Do these broad bands go away, or do they, you know, become broader, more pronounced?
They definitely go away. So they have to go away. So when you don't have periodicity, right, they will go away.
Right.
And every wave number will become unstable.
Yeah, so basically the broad resonance bands are not going away. They're staying there.
Yes.
So basically you see that for a generic omega, you have instability everywhere. So
if there's enough particle production. I mean, remember there's expansion, right? So just saying this in flat space is not enough.
Right, okay, yeah. But still, at least in this regard, preheating is kind of generic, right? Even, at least in terms of the form of the interactions, you would naturally expect to see exponential amplification. Certain amounts, yeah.
I still don't get the generic.
By the way, okay. You would also, for some parameters, you can also get the negative squared modes that would be taken on the regime.
True. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Especially in this case, right? I mean, here half of the period you're tachyonic for k going to zero, right? Yeah, and this is reflected by this very broad instability bands. But then again, here, even for k equal to zero, you're stable, which basically tells you that the phases here also matter, right? But yeah, otherwise, yeah, I mean, if we add expansion, then basically, I mean, here we have to add stuff, right? So do it more correctly. And basically, at a given moment in time, for a given amplitude, we are somewhere here. And then the co-moving modes will change their physical wave numbers, so they will start flowing across this chart. And basically, you know, sometimes expansion can just destroy this resonance instability by just moving modes outside of the instability bands faster than these modes can grow.
I'm not trying to be difficult with the generic image, but again, I mean, in the capacity, the way you're talking about this, perhaps.
Right.
But let's trade that, somebody already said this, for g squared, phi squared, chi squared.
Sure, okay.
So yeah. That'll spoil inflation by radiative corrections. That's like a textbook example of...
Yeah, unless g is very small, like...
So there, you would not expect radiative. Because you need to make g small enough so you don't induce those radiative corrections and introduce an ADO problem.
Right, yeah. So... Yeah, I mean, there the Floki chart is quantitative with the same. It's just that here you have large, bands of stability. But yeah, you're saying that there we already start somewhere close.
I'm just saying if you put constraints on the value of g from inflation, that value is outside the radiating scenario.
So yeah, there I don't really remember the number. It was something like 10 to a minus. Was it 7 or it was some combination?
10 to minus 3 to avoid the radiative correction.
Yeah.
And when it becomes smaller than 10 to minus 5 for m squared by squared radiative inflation,
you
are out of broad resonance.
Yeah, you have now, exactly. Yeah. So
then everybody would look at this one.
Okay. Yeah, but then again, this is just for scalar field decaying to another scalar field, right?
I mean, saying, like, so you've got the phi squared, chi squared, you got phi chi squared.
Right.
Phi chi squared, you might say it's generic, but then g squared, phi squared, chi squared, you'd say it's not generic, or it's not even possible.
Right.
That's why I'm curious about what's the generic.
Okay, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's not absolutely universal and generic, but I can't give a clear answer to that. Yeah, okay.
So all these regimes, they depend on the interplay between the M, sigma, and G, and I think there's also, there's some general analysis that people did, there's also like one more coupling people consider, so G, sigma, there's like some other ones. So it all depends on the interplay of these like three or four numbers, which regime you're in. So I'm not sure if it's obvious how one would answer, if it's generic or not.
That's what I'm meant to,
But the thing is about g squared, even if it's just g phi squared, chi squared, you always have the narrow bands, right? And I mean, at some point they will kick in, and or at least that's the hope that,
Put this in a little perspective, what I'm asking is, we tried to write down an effective field theory approach to this where you don't even specify the potential, and the major criticism was that it's always model dependent, and there is a generic notion of preheating, so that's why I'm asking.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well,
I think I would agree that it's not, I don't think it's necessary that you go to the preheating stage. So that you agree with.
Yeah.
But I don't know what, I really don't understand you. Like, I think the question of what do you mean by generic? Like, you want to put, I don't know what measure we are putting on the space of parameters to say generic or not. So until somebody tells me that, I don't know how we can answer that question.
I guess maybe he wants to know, does it increase the fine-tuning of ordinary inflationary scenarios by a significant amount by saying that there is a preheating scenario in the system? And I would guess probably not, given inflation is often fine-tuned, so...
But maybe it's good, because we're living in a fine-tuned world, no?
But anything else, what we are sure about is fine-tuned, right?
X is fine-tuned, lambda is fine-tuned, and we are sure about it.
And that's what we're talking about, things which are fine-tuned from the point of view of technical naturalness. And if you start talking about flavor, like 10 minus 6, you cover coupling for an electron, it's not fine-tuned from technical naturalness perspective, but it doesn't mean that this value comes from anywhere, right?
Yeah, that is still fine-tuned from a UV construction point of view, right?
Mm,
so even a direct mass, which is technically natural, you wouldn't expect string theory to suddenly generate a small mass scale at the electroweak scale if your only parameter is alpha prime. So all I'm saying is, it all depends on your perspective.
Of course. If you have infinite amount of different UV series, then you will have different infinite amount of the IR manifestations.
So I guess from some UV people's perspective, where they think they can have resummation control over that kind of potential, which plateaus some of these eta problem worries that we have from doing Taylor expansion about the minimum, maybe a red herring, maybe.
But even if it's not string theory, there's the Planck scale, so you still have to explain this smallness of the number.
Yeah. But this is too far from Planck scale. A bit closer than us, but no one wants.
Yeah.
Just that hierarchy we usually don't worry about it, right? I mean, because you can do, I mean, this is the distinction that you're also making, well, that's technically natural. Now, from the proton, I assume you're not that worried about it.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not talking about, I don't know, QCD scale is so different from Planck scale. In a sense, it's kind of random.
Scott, the other thing about not, this is not answering the generic question, but suppose you have many fields. That's the end of inflation. Many fields are sloshing about it. Right now we're doing a very simple example, right? So typically if you write down the fluctuations of one field, then all the other, the backgrounds of all the other fields will act as an effective mass. And they might be changing in a non-periodic, but potentially...
Basically you can give things like that. Yeah.
Adiabatic fashion. Yeah. And that at least can produce particles non-adiabatically. Whether that is the dominant source with which you decay is not entirely clear. But certainly you will have that non-adiabaticity even if you don't have a single thing oscillating around. In that sense, you should at least think about it non-adiabaticity, whether it's the only thing that causes the full inflaton decay or it makes it inhomogeneous or not, is somewhat model dependent.
Yeah, but yeah, basically periodicity is not a necessary condition for preheating. So in this sense, preheating can be considered slightly general, right?
Both enhancement happens whether you have periodicity or not.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So yeah, I'm not sure yet. Periodicity is like can be used for constructing an EFT or not. Okay, but yeah, assuming that this happens, then you run into the second stage of preheating, the nonlinear stage. We think that it's also kind of inevitable given the first stage. I mean, again, a simple example meant to provoke it. So now we play with the fluctuations of the inflaton itself. There's something like that, I guess. Right. Yeah, and basically, I mean, if this guy grows exponentially, this means that, well, the solutions to this equation will also grow, you know, exponentially. In fact, you know, with an exponential index twice the, you know, the exponential rate and growth rate of the chi itself. And yeah, at some point, this can catch up with the actual background. Value of the condensate of the inflaton. So basically, once, if you like, the field variance, which also grows with the same rate, it becomes comparable to the mean squared of the inflaton, then you say that, you know, if we can call this the first stage of the nonlinear stage, the back reaction stage, here you know that back reaction has kicked in. That's a very rough way of saying it, but I guess that's how people estimate when you become nonlinear. And you can see, since this grows as e to the mu t, the time it takes to become nonlinear or to start worrying about nonlinear effects or mode-mode couplings is a factor of u, of a few divided by mu. Right? So, yeah, the Floki exponent essentially determines the back reaction time scale. Yeah, how does this look in position space? Well, I mean, you can just run a simulation. Now I'm going to create a movie with one snapshot. Yeah, so basically, at least for this case where you have sigma chi squared phi, I mean, Andre knows this better. Okay, he's away. You end up with some sort of a foam-like structure. So it's just bubbles with most of their energy concentrated in their walls. kind of cool. So basically, around the time of Beck reaction, you see that Beck reaction starts first in the underdense regions. If they're underdense, this means that the potential energy is lower, which means that the pressure is higher. So energy gets evacuated from, you know, huge underdense regions, and it gets concentrated in these bubble-like walls. And it looks pretty cool, at least in the movie. But of course, nobody cares about it because this is further the horizon. So it's very, very short, very short scales. And yeah, that's pretty much, you know, the beginning of the nonlinear stage. Afterwards, we enter into the nonlinear dynamic stage, like fully nonlinear dynamics. I don't know how to call it, where you can get, broadly speaking, either the turbulence you mentioned, or soliton, depending on the actual model at hand. And the turbulence stage is also quite long-lived. By also, I mean solitons. We also assume that they're long-lived. So, pretty much inevitably, you end up with a with a long-lived stage of nonlinear dynamics. What do we mean by turbulence? Well, again, I guess first I have to make the movie. So now there's the movie of turbulence. If I have two snapshots. So this bubble-like or foam-like structure breaks down when you enter the fully nonlinear regime into just blobs.
Before you go, so when you said nobody cares about the bubbles, why not?
No, because they're all sub-horizon, so that's very short scales, right? At least that's...
It's happening everywhere in acausal patches as well, too, right? And so when we expand, wouldn't that stuff come in to be interesting?
Well, I mean, they're very short-lived and all that, but yeah, I mean...
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They're definitely very short-lived, right? I mean...
Yeah, but I wouldn't say nobody cares about the
bubbles. <No. laughs> I was like, no, more people should care. I was just being, you know, judgmental. Sorry. Yeah, you must care about it. Yeah, it's cool.
Can they produce maybe gravitational
waves? Yes, indeed. Not maybe a lot, actually. Yeah. But they are very high frequency for the same reason.
Right. Yeah, it's that's the, you know, relevant scale.
And there are models to do also body genesis and or to produce PVH, you know? I mean, you can do all of nasty things with them.
Yeah.
Any derivatively coupled reheating channels probably gets enhanced in that bubble wall, right?
Probably.
Yeah, because the gradients are high there.
Oh yeah, they are. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, yeah, this is a very short-lived, you know, state of the fields. Very quickly, these bubble walls just fragment into blobs of energy, which more or less move.
Okay. When you say fast, can you give me a time mass scale?
Less than, I mean, if there is an M, it's less than M, or at most order M.
1 M.
Yeah, M, 1 M. And bear in mind that M is much greater than H because the inflaton oscillates already.
What I mean, from the beginning of preheating until the bubbles collide, which is the onset of nonlinearity, mm-hmm. there can be quite a number of oscillations of the inflaton.
No, yeah, but the point is that these bubbles form once the variance becomes comparable to the mean, right?
Well, that's when you see them observable by the eye, you
sure.
know, but
yeah.
You know, the instability is growing from the beginning. You
yeah,
know?
Oh yeah. So yeah, there's always this rich valley, you know, peak structure in the
exactly.
over densities. Yeah. Basically, this parametric resonance, if you like, acts as a low-pass filter of the initial conditions. So you really amplify them, but yeah, you don't really see them by eye until the point where you reach, you know.
But that would be the linear beam, right?
Yes, that's the linear beam.
Oh, well, yeah, and this happens right at the end of the linear region. That's why I'm saying that this is very short. If probably I should have not put it here, but it just looks cool when you know, make the movie.
What are the size of the bubbles?
Well, it's sub-horizon. It's sub-horizon. It is basically determined by the fastest growing mode here. So it's indeed a 4 M, right? Yeah. Because basically the Floch, exponent, well, the Fock index grows as you move in this direction.
Okay, so that's why it disappears on time scales for order n and not Hubble.
Yeah.
Because their size is really small.
Yeah, but yeah, so this, I mean, you just see it happening and then disappearing, like torture snapshots in general, not only here. And yeah, so then, yeah, you get these blobs, and these blobs with time, so this is now when we're nonlinear, so this is after this happens. These blobs with time move more or less freely, and they also disintegrate into smaller blobs in a self-consistent, there is some sort of a scaling solution. So with time, these blobs become more and more, and smaller and smaller. So it should be more blobs than here. And that's in position space. In Floquet, well, in Fourier space, you can understand it much better. If you just plot the occupation numbers of the Doppler field, you can see that you have some sort of a Kolmogorov-like power spectrum. You can derive from relativistic stellar field turbulence. I cannot do it right now, obviously. But it looks like it's kind of non-thermal. Here you have a power law that's like -3/2 for like massless fields. And with time, you have upscattering of modes. So this goes down and to higher momentum. So that's pretty much what I mean by turbulence. And this can be very long-lived, this like scaling solution. And yeah.
What's on the vertical axis again?
The occupation number of a K mode. Yeah, I mean we define it, I mean, very hand wavily obviously, by just, you know, treating it as a harmonic oscillator. So we have kind of this definition. This equals the energy of normally it's like that. If it has a mass, we add the mass here as well. And omega k is whatever is the effective frequency of the k mode.
What's very long lived?
If you don't add any additional interactions, this proceeds forever, at least in simulations. It doesn't stop. If you increase the UV resolution of your simulations, it just stays there. Obviously, there are physical arguments here. If you were to plot the energy density of that, you would see that always, the cutoff is what really dominates your energy density. And since the cutoff is moving towards higher K, at some point you might excite the Planck K. So this is a problem, this one problem. And the other problem is that the occupation number kind of decreases with time because you go down and to the right. At some point, your dominant mode in terms of energy may have occupation number less than one. And then the classical simulations also break down. So there are, things to worry about. But otherwise, if you just, let the simulations run forwards, this survives forever.
So there's no dissipation in the system? Usually that's after.
Well, this is pretty much it. The dissipation comes from the interaction. So this upscattering, right?
Oh, the cascade.
Yeah, the cascade is driven by the, so there's no dissipation like.
The same as dissipation.
Yeah. It's not like viscosity in Kolmogorov turbulence. Yeah. So this is called free turbulence. It's driven free turbulence in the sense that there is no dissipation, which makes it kind of free, and driven because there is a remnant condensate which keeps kind of dumping slightly energy here, so it's slightly messy. But even without this condensate, you still have the free turbulence, which is essentially that, just the cascading.
So if I plot the energy density, you're saying it's peaked at the cutoff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, then you're saying the energy density peak is moving to the right.
To the right and
as
down.
As a function of time.
Yeah, but also down.
I see.
Yeah, or not down, but I mean, it depends on the, I'm thinking in terms of scale factor node, but if you remove the expansion of the universe, it's just, moving horizontally because you conserve energy.
So at the beginning, I understand it's not too productive to think of it in terms of particles, but at some point, shouldn't I think of them in terms of particles?
Well, it's more like classical wave, interacting classical wave picture or something like that. I mean, that's pretty much what we're hearing here. I mean, maybe now I should mention something about the, you know, the tools we use just to
get. So is this statement then, as far as your nonlinear simulation is showing, there are scenarios where your turbulent states are sensitive to Planck scale, because you're basically saying you have a cutoff at the Planck scale?
Well, they could be. Obviously, this is much lower than the Planck scale, but yeah, I mean, naively, if you just let it evolve, you might.
How long does it take to get to the Planck scale?
Well, it's more dependent, right? But yeah, I mean, it's. Yeah, if m is like 10 to a minus 6 m Planck,
I think it's very slow.
It's very slow.
It's true because there's no other cutoff. Yes, because it's a quadratic Planck field, because there should be just classical conservation and eventually this.
Also, probably one should compare it with vacuum fluctuations of the same chi and the same k. And these vacuum fluctuations will grow with k, right? Because the shorter is the scale, the larger is really vacuum fluctuation.
All right.
The massless field. So then basically you would need to compare it, then at some moment it will be as big as vacuum fluctuation, is it?
All right. Well, I mean, when you run these simulations, basically, I mean, these simulations solve the classical, the classical interacting Gordon system. With the Einstein equations, ideally. And the initial setup is just a Phi field with some small fluctuations and a chi field, which is just fluctuations. And basically, if you consider how the power spectrum, say, of chi evolves with time, something like this, at the very beginning, since we're interested only in subhorizon scales, we start with a blue vacuum power spectrum, and then as parametric resonance or whatever instability kicks in, you see the development of, you know, instability bands. It could be a broad one, whatever. And something similar happens with the phi field, with the inflaton. But here the back reaction basically is represented by just the excitation of flow momentum modes. And if you normalize this by phi squared, when you hit one, you become nonlinear. And the same is here. And yeah, basically, normally when we have excited modes, we lie above the vacuum fluctuations. But then again, yeah, there are cases where, you know, not always we lie above the vacuum fluctuations. Sometimes if we don't excite anything here, and if we just we cut off the initial power spectrum here, then we see that we lie under the vacuum fluctuations, right? So yeah, I don't know. I mean, the usual trick I think most people use is they just initialize k modes which are known to be unstable. So initially we do the linear analysis, we see which modes are unstable, and then we check this on the lattice, and if it works, we just initialize these vacuum modes. And the rest we keep at zero, and then we hope that back reaction will excite the rest. So, I mean, I don't know how to treat vacuum situations otherwise. And so if anyone runs simulations, yeah, please keep an eye on your power spectra. That's the most important, I guess, diagnostic of a simulation. You don't want to be dominated by UV modes when you're nonlinear, because if you're dominated, the simulations are most likely corrupt. Here's a quick, I guess, review of the available codes you can play with or make students play with.
I think, coming before we move on, something I don't think we should take this as this is the I don't think this always happens. It's still model dependent that you will enter a turbulent stage or not.
If you have only scalar fields, I claim that if you have a fragmentation of the fields and there are no solitonic objects floating around, turbulence is kind of inevitable.
So an interesting case I've simulated is a scalar field charge under U1, coupled to U1 gauge fields. And I would have thought, because of the gauge interaction, that kind of mimics the chi squared phi squared. Mm-hmm. And however, the field distribution, classically, does not enter into this self-similar scaling regime characteristic of turbulence. And I don't know if there's any particular reason.
What do you get? Okay. What do you get from that? Do you get turbulence?
Well, I get a distribution of the occupation number, which are evolving in time, but they cannot be fit into this manner of this so-called weak kinetic turbulence. Okay.
Well, I mean, I guess at least to me, the hallmark of turbulence is when you plot the when you do the one-point statistic of the energy density. So this is the probability of the energy density. If it's log normal, then there must be some turbulence happening there because that's a generic null prediction of turbulence to have a log normal of energy density. That's the one-point statistic, right? So it's just e to the minus whatever log rho minus something minus the mean divided by sigma squared. So I haven't played much with this for the gauge field, so maybe there's something funny happening there. But for scalar fields, it was first shown by Andre, I think, that for all two scalar field models, you enter such a regime, a distinct, well, a long-lived regime of, you know, log normal distribution of the energy density, and we showed that with Mustafa for single scalar fields as well.
And as you were saying, also gauge fields you don't know, and also with solitons there is a second one.
Yeah. But whereas if you have
scalar fields,
it's single scalar field
from the self interactions. You enter always the.
Yeah, with the oscillons you basically generate a plateau here, right? And as expansion takes over, this peak moves to the left, but this plateau stays here, right? So basically, that's pretty much the radiation of the scalar field. But for gauge fields, it would be interesting.
So just to confirm, so what you guys see in the simulation is that there's kind of several regimes. So it's either you get the fragmentation, the solitons, but if this is not the case, then you either have this self-similar solution, or you have basically a solution that is not self-similar, but there is no. So this would correspond to a statement that
the case simulation could be same.
So this would be non-linear dynamics are on short-lived time scale, or is that not the case? This third case.
Sorry,
without the turbulence, and what would they correspond in the classification if you do that?
So I mean, if you had solitons, you'd still you get a long-lived state, right? Or these objects, metastable, just hanging around there. They end up dominating the energy density. So that's a long-term state.
Right.
That's one case. In this case, the long-lived state is a turbulence phase. I think those are the two phases. And then, I guess that, what Danny's saying with gauge fields, there's some, another quasi, if you look at the power spectrum, it's quasi-stationary.
Quite self-similar. But it's not self-similar.
It's not self-similar in this way. So it's a quasi, it always reaches some quasi-stationary regime. One way or the other, but it doesn't.
There is cascading, obviously. The question is whether this cascading is self-similar.
Exactly.
That's a good
question.
Yeah. But you can just play with these models and prove us wrong, right? But also cite us. So. And there are amazing tools available out there. Just all of your hopes and dreams will come true. So just check them out. So just for scalar fields in FRW, you can use LatticeEZ, probably the first publicly available lattice code, very pedagogically, you know, documented. So if you have a starting PhD student, maybe that's not a bad starting point. But then again, they're, you know, rising better lattice code, so they should mount new lattice.
This is only for FRW, right?
This is only for FRW, yeah. So Andreas DeFrost, I've seen only versions which work for FRW. Maybe he has better. I'm sure he has better ones, but he never shares. So. Yeah. Also, by cool, right? I mean, this is some. They're all good. If you want to add gravitational waves, you have H lattice. What else? Gabe by Tom Gibney. Very nice code. You have obviously Zach's Pi Stella. Well, Stella, but no. He can tell you more about it. What else with. Full GR, you have a version of Gabriel, right? As far as I know, that's the name, yeah, which can do full GR. Obviously, GR Chombo, Eugene Lim's code, which is very comprehensive, but yeah, very big as well. If you want to have gauge fields, the future, obviously, Dan is producing an amazing code now, but it's not public yet, I guess, Cosmolattice. Also our code GFire. It's not completely shared, but the algorithm is out there, so we can just code it up. And again, Zach's code, PyStell, can do gate shoots. And I'm sure, yeah, Zach is going to add the GRSO at some point, so, yeah.
This is huge code. Does it work for other backgrounds than FRW, right?
When I say plus GR, I'm saying, definitely works for FRW, but it doesn't need to be. I mean, the metric can be arbitrary, ideally. But then again, I mean, I don't know, maybe there's some technical difficulties to really make the metric complete. there's plenty of codes now, so just play with them. And we should also think about, you know, some interesting, you know, models which can give rise to observational consequences, right? So that we can start constraining these scenarios. Now is the time to start listing the future work, well, the future for heating. So, future directions. I don't know, I normally split into observational consequences and, model building, if you like. Yeah, and here we can have, as we said, gravitational waves. We can improve constraints on inflationary observables inferred from the CMB by improving our understanding of NS star, the number of falls before the interpolation when the pivot scale left the horizon. So far there is an uncertainty, so N star is allowed to vary between 50 and 60, only because we don't know what happened during reheating. And if we have a better understanding of reheating, we can shrink this theoretical or model-related uncertainty. Maybe we can get some non-Gaussianities. I don't know if PBH belongs here or here, but yeah, PBH as well. For model building, as Danny is saying, we need to think more carefully about reheating into the standard model. Can we really, you know, maintain the inflaton potential at the right form while, effectively producing the standard model, so effective decays? Also, we need to worry about biogenesis because it happened out of local thermal equilibrium, so by definition, it must have happened during some stage of reheating. And yeah, I mean, I don't know what else.
Magnetogenesis, presumably.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a lot. Yeah, so I don't know where it went, but yeah, magnetogenesis.
Yeah, something I'm definitely curious about is, so it seems that you can create quite a lot of inhomogeneities. They're still on sub-horizon scales at that time. It's a very, at least for some while, it's a very non-thermal distribution of energy densities and fields. Is there some particle physics process that would strongly depend on the fact that locally it's extremely inhomogeneous that would give a prediction that was very different, say, if you assume that this was a homogeneous distribution on that scale? And I can't think of, we've tried to look at things, but I think it's interesting to think that whether the fact that it's a very non-thermal distribution and inhomogeneous distribution, albeit on very small scales, can that change the late-time particle physics productions given a model?
I think the answer is obviously yes.
Yes?
Yeah, yeah. Right. As we were just saying, right. Anything that couples to the derivative term will be enhanced.
And what kind of things would you, what is the final observable that we would look for in that context?
Well, almost any standard model coupling will have derivative coupling to the sector. So.
But eventually, the abundance
of... like dark matter portals, right? They're derivative coupling portals.
But in terms of the final abundance of dark matter, standard model species and so on, you will end up in thermal equilibrium at some point. And those will determine the relative densities.
Yeah, so does it matter? As far as the observation is concerned, they thermalize. That's the problem. Yeah.
Right, so that's
so your question is there non-thermalized... That's right. Quantity, and yes. I guess you can always cook it up. Basically analogs of axionic models, right, that are very weakly interacting, you can always have derivative coupling that will generate.
So it has to be something not that remains till today in that statement. Dark matter, of course, could be including one example. I can't think of anything else that would.
Something that may remain if there is a phase transition involved is topological defects.
That's true.
That we have not covered.
And if you have low scale systems where you can generate gravity waves, maybe that's observable, then you can add another component to the spectrum.
It's too high frequencies.
Nobody
is learning. When you reduce the energy scale to produce them at more observable frequencies, you kill completely the signal, unless a phase transition.
Is that obvious why you kill the signal?
I don't know if it's obvious, but that's...
Because the universe shouldn't care how homogeneous it gets based on what the energy scale of the H is, right? That is not dependent on...
Yeah, it's not obvious, but it at least that's the scaling I have for typical cases. I wouldn't call it obvious,
Because
you are right, the relative distribution of energy should matter, whatever the energy scale. And this is actually the case for phase transitions, and that's why, for instance, for electrowave phase transitions, you can support a high signal, hence at the lower frequencies. But for preheating, this doesn't happen.
But I don't understand. I mean, I would imagine that you could cook up things that...
I've tried
really hard. But G squared pi squared was the one you tried, if I remember correctly, right?
Like no, right. I mean, I think the only scenario I know from preheating that can produce observable relative waves is hybrid preheating. If you fine tune the soft coupling of the Higgs like something to down to 10 to minus 40. So, if you go to 10 to minus 40, it's like, then I can have the, but probably such extrapolation from what we've measured in the lattice is not even correct, you know.
Because, for example, right, so at least one paper with Keller and Gigi and Yuji Fan and Matt Rees, we tried to do this, instead of the inflaton, we did it with the modulus. In that case...
Could you maybe...
You could get it to around between kilohertz and a megahertz. Yes. A little bit higher than, should say kilohertz, megahertz is more appropriate. You could get enough gravitational waves like order 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 10 to the minus 8 is what we got maximum.
Okay. But that's similar to preheating, but then but it's below megahertz, it dies again.
Below megahertz, we couldn't do that there, if I remember correctly. You could never get there. Mm-hmm. But megahertz, we could get.
Okay. Certainly with the spectator fields, I played around and they are also.
Yeah, it would be interesting to actually see if there is some
mechanism.
Of course,
it would be great.
Which was not so. And Scott, you looked at moduli, but in your conclusion, it was more that you don't have any nonlinear dynamics, essentially, right?
Yeah, that was the conclusion.
Can you remind us, like, why?
Which paper are
you talking about? Is the universe.
Is the universe.
Matter dominated.
Before BVM, the paper with Tom.
Yeah. I mean, basically, it was the strength of the couplings.
So the effect, from an EFT perspective, you put in natural things and you thought that you can't dump in energy fast enough from the modulus into other things.
That's what
we should That's why you're right. So that would be good to sort of think about if you can produce gravitational waves or at lower frequencies.
So, okay, we moduli field to see if we can vary the parameters to shift the. To lower frequencies and yet sustains big amplitude of gravitational waves.
I think Scott's paper would say that the natural couplings you write down don't allow you to do that.
I see.
With moduli fields. That was his, if I remember correctly, that was the.
So natural couplings, meaning what in particular?
Well, it's like, I think we looked at. I'm rusty on the paper, sorry.
It's like
high X, Y depth stuff, and then you put in like Planck's suppress to get the dimensions right. And even if, and the more you lowered the cutoff, I believe, the worse it gets.
I see.
But yeah, basically with gravitational waves, if you really want to lower the frequency, you have to, I guess, play with the equation of state between the time of generation of the gravitational waves and BBN. And if you basically play with the expansion history in a favorable way for the frequency, if you want to bring it from megahertz to, say, a hertz, this also immediately brings down the energy density in the gravitational waves.
Yes.
Basically, you want a matter-like equation of state, something faster than radiation domination, so with W less than 1/3 between the generation of gravitational waves and PBN. And this immediately redshifts the gravitational edge generated, you know, faster. Yeah.
It's a factor, it's an exponent is 1 over 4, right? Because it's energy density compared to frequency.
Yeah.
So it's a parametric shift of frequency is much slower than the key link of the amplitude there. That's the problem.
Yeah.
If you're just mentioned.
Well, yeah, I guess you can talk about this next week more.
Yeah, okay, one more.
Yeah, I guess to say, just so I don't sound crazy. So, I mean, the point was we couple the modulus to gauge fields. You put a cutoff, and you want to make sure you don't take more than larger than order one couplings, because otherwise the effective field theory doesn't make sense.
And with order one couplings, you...
That would make no sense, because then I need all the terms in the expansion. So it has to be less than one, and then if you did that, you saw there was no... Excellent.
So, Scott, what happened? Sorry, now, did the paper that we had with Juju and Matt and Cullen, did that violate that in some way? Because we certainly saw, we were coupling a modulus to a Higgs-like thing, and there it was...
Well, no, I mean, if you... I mean, that's the difference. We were looking at gauge fields.
Okay. Maybe that was...
I mean, you could have normalizable couplings in the modulus. Yeah, if you had, like, H, that's the difference between non-normalizable and normalizable. And in our case, it would be radiation having a non-normalizable point.
Well, we should look into those scalings to understand. Okay.
I think, as Carlo answered, right, we have a few things, like on the gravitational side, we say gravitational waves is the obvious one that people have been working on for a long time now, since Tokarczuk and... Klemnikov and Tokarczuk a long time ago, people have been thinking about this. And you can think about primordial black holes or gravitational clustering in the early universe, how structure forms. So the gravitational side, I think those are the new things that people have been looking at. But I think on the non-gravitational side, not that much, it hasn't been made use of, as far as I can tell. That there is this non-thermal phase. And again, as we discussed, it's because things, the standard model degrees of freedom thermalize, so you kind of lose information. But that side of things, that would be interesting to think if there's something that's left over.
I have a stupid question. What do you say? I mean, the thermal black holes can be something interesting. I mean, if you're generating them when they evaporate them. I mean, you generate them during breathing, they are going to be super small and they evaporate super quick, you know?
So you could have these black mass relics, no, because it's not clear. What can be the leftover there?
Mm. Well, it's not interesting. I've seen people have discussed it.
It's more like
what's happening with new things that people
I would think, these stuff are so small and they should be evaporating and they should not give you anything.
Well, you can spin the opposite way. You can use them to preheat, right? I mean, to reheat you.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody who's reheating has had this fantasy at some point, right? You go from the inputon to primordial black holes and that reheats the universe, you never have to worry about anything else. All the couplings, right? Everybody, I'm sure, has thought about it at some point.
Yeah, it passed my mind, but I never...
Like, if you go, oh, this will be the way it works, then you don't have to worry about anything about the couplings.
But if you generate VH, for example, what I was saying, from solitons later on, then this is not an issue, right? So, I mean, it's part of the kind of statement.
It would, if there's a way of doing that, but I don't see a way of taking all of the inflaton energy and putting it just into it, mostly into PBHs. Like it's just hard to imagine how you do that. But if you could, then it'd be great. Because
I mean, even if it were like soliton or something, you'd have to get rid of all the soliton.
Yes.
Right. Well, but you can have oscillating scalar fields that produce, if you had a matter-dominated phase, then you could produce a bunch of primordial black holes. They're heavy enough that they don't evaporate.
The solitons then they usually decay later on because, for example, you know, for cubos there is usually an additional high order couplings.
But actually, maybe you should ask the question: can you? Is it maybe? I don't know if it's possible. Can you reheat the universe just with primordial black holes? If there was a way of producing them.
Well, you also need barogenesis there, right? Somehow to throw it into that.
You could.
So if you form them just by like hyperinflation, right? Okay. Then it's not any of this mechanism. It's just large density perturbations at the end of inflation. Mm-hmm. Then as long as they Hawking evaporate before BBN, then you're good, right?
But is it consistent? They can dominate the energy density initially, yes, because they have matter.
Yeah, it's just like matter. How do you tell the difference between that and just the heavy inflation or something that's oscillating?
But
you mean you generate them with direct inflation? I mean, with the inflationary mechanism, you generate them later.
No, in hybrid inflation, you can cook the system such that you go into ultra slow roll or some similar regime, and you enhance your power spectrum a lot.
Yeah, but you don't have the promoted decals doing inflation right there.
No, you predict that afterwards, but if you do that towards the end of inflation, it's a very short scale.
You were saying immediately after inflation, you generate a bunch of them.
Soon after inflation, you produce them, then they decay soon enough before the
But I'm confused about it. If you want to do that, you still have some of it will go into black holes, some of it will be in the inflaton aspect, if you will, left over. Say with the black holes, you evaporate, but there's still the inflaton left over. That then you have to still worry about how you're going to decay. Because the whole, what I was asking is, can we get rid of, do we have to worry about the couplings to the inflaton? Can we cook up a scenario where everything goes in the black holes? So you don't have, because then you can just use Hawking to reheat.
Well, that's what we tried with the osteons, right?
It's difficult, no? Because I don't see how to balance the energy. You produce this fluctuation in the power spectrum that later on turn into black holes, but it's not that they can take all the energy, usually something's still there.
I mean, you need to somehow decay the inflation fast, so that it goes to radiation.
And it seems that, and then you get back to the question, you don't know the couplings of the inflation to everything else. So black holes, you could make some decay, it's going to use everything democratically. But I don't.
It's part of the reason why particle people haven't really looked into these sort of things. And somehow it's the opposite of the normal philosophy, which is like if you just ask people why do they like WIMP, it's because it doesn't care about the universe. I want to care a lot about the universe. So it's sort of exactly the opposite of the propaganda themselves.
In very, I'm sure people know, in very rare cases where if the production cost or something depends very heavily on energy, like in fib dark matter or something like that, then you push it back to reheating.
Yeah, so like the old school people who really like gravitinos actually cares about the mass of reheat temperature. And then it actually matters in this case that it's not thermal and then so for those gravitino people, this actually would matter.
They essentially worry about, you know, collective decay of fine whatever, the gravitinos, because you can produce really massive particles because of this.
Then also like the spectrum of energy, number of densities actually matters.
Right.
That's true. And like the fact that you start off getting pushed to higher, more support out there might actually be an interesting feature for them and whatnot.
Which is, I mean, it changes, for example, the dark matter abundance calculation by orders of magnitude if you try to do it that way. If you don't, even if you just do the fact that you're decaying not from a thermal distribution but from just inflaton essentially address changes the answer by quite a large amount. Mm-hmm.
So why do people say that the gravity waves have to be much higher frequency? If you had all this happening at a TeV, then wouldn't it even be in Lisa range?
Yeah.
And so you could push it up a little bit.
Frequency-wise, yes, but the amplitude is super suppressed for these mechanisms.
So I guess that's because none of this is Hubble-sized bubbles, like you get in first-order phase transitions,
It's because somehow in a first-order phase transition, you can manage to have an isotropic stress very large, but here you can
never actually get
it. But I still don't understand that, right? Because if this is the total energy density of the universe, it shouldn't matter when you do this. Yeah. It really shouldn't matter.
Yeah, I guess this statement was just the quadruple.
I mean, we can review the algebra how it applies to that, but it does apply to that for parametric resonance.
Because usually, right, parametric resonance happens on scales. It's not on Hubble, but it's 10 or 100 times smaller than Hubble.
Yeah, a few orders smaller.
But that's also what happens in bubble walls. Usually, it's down by the beta factor, which is of order 100.
Right,
so that's just the action.
It's the same thing, exactly. So it's very similar. And so that's why I don't understand. Physically,
I cannot give you a physical clear answer. I just know what's the scaling, and then we measure it in the simulations.
So one thing that happened with what Nicola had discussed is that if you want to tie it to the inflationary model, then the amplitude of the perturbations and so on constrain to some extent, like the shape of the scales and the potential and so on. And that was causing it difficult to make very large amounts of vibration waves. But it's not obvious to say.
Yeah.
From a physical argument, without going into details, it's certainly not obvious why you should be able to do this at a low energy scale.
On the top of my head, I cannot tell you any clear argument, but I do have easy notes to understand it other than reading the paper, so we can, I can show you.
But I guess yeah, that's a good point to remember just this rule of thumb that was invented by Tom, I guess, or just for the gravitational waves. I mean, you can very nicely, you know, derive what's omega GW0 of the gravitational waves, like very quickly, from such, you know, process like bubble formation, or like just parametric resonance and back reaction. I mean, if you just derive the, if you just write down the equation of motion for gravitational waves, you basically see that H is of order the TT over Laplacian, and then the energy of the gravitational waves is just like gradient squared M Planck squared, which means that it's just TT squared divided by M Planck squared and by 1 delta, and you can just multiply and divide by H squared, and you basically see that rho GW at the time of generation of gravitational waves is just TT over the critical density, and we have H over K squared. So we call this quantity normally delta, that's the energy density in the TT, well, the fractional energy density. So basically, and well, now you can parameterize however you want, but if you want to get omega GW, you just remember it's scales as, you know, whatever, radiation. So if we, it should be something like that, up to some correction factors coming from the change of the number of, you know, relativistic degrees of freedom in the thermal bath. But it basically looks something like that. So from here you see that omega GW is just omega GW at the today, at the generation, times omega of the relativistic degrees of freedom today. And this one, I forgot to guess a factor of rho, but yeah, it's in there as well. So basically the rule of thumb is that omega GW today is simply omega relativistic today times H over K squared times the fractional energy density in the TT squared. So basically you see that when you're on subhorizon scales, you're suppressed as per usual for gravitational perturbations. And this supported 10 to minus 5. This, I guess, it depends. For preheating, this can be as high as almost 1/3, whereas for some phase transition of some dark sector, this can be really, really low. So, whereas, for example, for some gauge field models, Zach, for example, finds that this can be a order 1, which can really boost up your omega GW. So, yeah, that's a good rule of thumb to remember to have in mind. And now, of course, this assumes that immediately after the production of gravitational waves, you're radiation-dominated. But if you assume that you're matter-dominated, this can be, this omega GW goes down.
I think I remember now a little bit the problem. Like, in a phase transition, you can have the nucleation of your bubbles at any energy scale, and they can represent a sizable fraction of your total energy density. And this can happen in any moment. Yeah. But for preheating, this cannot happen at arbitrary energy scales. Like when you go to a small energy scales, it's not easy to have these non-perturbative effects that you need to produce these inhomogeneous configurations in first place. I think this is a bit the logic.
I don't see that because it's, again, if you just, I mean, all you need is produce fluctuations on. So H over K is this V over C squared. Right? This is how relativistic your system is, as you know. Right? So that doesn't depend at all on what energy scale you're at. It's a dimensionless thing.
It does not, but it does whether you can produce this delta dt as large as...
I think that's, again, it's, yeah. Again, how much of your initial energy density can you produce, can you translate to gradients, right? Or TT?
Sure. It's what's your ability to do that, and I think for the lower energy scale models, this is what is not easy through parametric resonance. You are not in the Gauss resonance regime to produce this.
But is this like a chi pi squared chi squared? Yeah. Like, I know it probably goes that way, but
in general, I wouldn't say that's a general rule.
Is the claim just that when you can see gradient thing, even though you can see them by eye, they're not actually like super, super, like all the energies in them?
No,
a sizable fraction can be.
Yeah, they can be
a sizable fraction.
Yeah. So that sounds like delta TT is
exactly.
One.
It's usually, you can make it. So I don't. I don't understand why it doesn't work at low energies. Because none of the. They're all dimensionless ratios in terms of what the scale is at that time.
It's not the same as in our paper, but I mean, typically in models where the scale was lower, also you were in production well inside the horizon and that was suppressing things. I might be using the same stuff or not.
I don't know. Physically, I don't understand why that would be.
Let's review it after
we do that. We can discuss.
So, sorry,
I'm also not sure, but it's. I think I'm.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe on Wednesday, as you said, if you guys would have some discussion or
this.
Although I was planning to elaborate it away from cosmic strings, but we can reshuffle.
And I think, you should also mention that here, if you put in gauge fields and something with you want, you would get cosmic strings here as well. Topological effects also, something we didn't discuss, but you can also
do that.
Not sure.
Conclusion is, it's fine. We don't know if we can observe it, but...
are you considering specific models of baryogenesis related to this? I saw Juan Garcia Bolito had some related papers, but don't know.
High nuclear heat in a... Yes.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, actually,
yesterday
the speaker was presenting yesterday or 2 days ago could be embedded here, no? Somehow.
All right, the organizer needs to eat lunch, so.
Yeah.